Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Bill Estep, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you. Allow me to introduce our speakers. On my far left is Eleanor N. of South Carolina. In the middle is Martin A. of Ontario. And last but not least, Roger L. of Nevada.
Your reading section.
He brought his own reading section with him, by the way. Paid their fare and everything. Okay. Now, I would like to introduce Eleanor from South Carolina.
My name is Elle, and I'm an alcoholic. And I would like to thank the General Service Board of the United States and Canada and the 2005 International Coordinator, Doug Richardson, for this loving invitation to participate in this 70th anniversary. It's quite an honor to be here. Typically, we tell our experience, strength, and hope, but I did not share in a 12-step, in the old-fashioned way to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. On June 24, 1985, I entered the rooms of AA upon the suggestion of a professional counselor. So following Dr. Silkworth's recanting of Bill's story, I'm going to tell you about my two most recent sponsors and how they were 12-stepped. On September the 21st, Katie P. took her last drink. It was impossibly hot in those days of summer in West Virginia. She had been around the AA rooms about 3 years earlier, but she was told she was too young to be an alcoholic, and the men said that they had spilled more than she drank. She thought, certainly they know whether I belong here or not. At 17 years old, she left this opportunity of finding help, but that event was not without a special seed, because she had met, in that brief moment, Regina R. Katie tells horror stories of her continued collapse into the disease during those intervening 3 years. She reports she couldn't go a full day without a drink, and she was drinking around the clock. And there's one story, one vivid picture that I have when she tells her story. It's about walking to work, and she's fortified with apricot brandy. She said it was during the period of time when you couldn't get regular booze, so she had apricot brandy. And she said she'd take a step or two, and then she'd have to stop, and she was swaying, and she would swat at the fruit flies flying around her head, because out of every pore was this fruity smell of apricot. So, but the treacherous path back to the AA room ended in a cheap hotel room. Out of booze and feeling like she was dying, she called out, "Please, God, help me." Like that, a mantle of warmth came over her. I asked her about these words before I came up here. And I said, "Is this true?" And she said, "Yes." I called out. And she said she felt protected. And at that moment, she said she knew that there was a God. And in the hallway outside of her room, there were people moving about. And she wasn't certain, but she heard a voice. And so she called the front desk and said, "Is that Regina R?" And they said, "Yes, she's moving into the room next door to yours." Katie believed that this was a God thing. And she asked the desk to please call Regina to let her know that Katie P. was next door. The old-fashioned 12-stepping for Katie was the loving hands and heart of Regina, who sat with her while she detoxed. Katie hallucinated while she sweated in that hot little hotel room. This is one of her visions she shared with me. It's a vision of a black cat covered in axle grease. And this black cat slid up over the top of the bed, over the foot of the bed, and slid along her body and sat on her chest, and she could barely breathe. And it had iridescent yellow glowing eyes that just stared into hers. And another story she tells about hairless Boston Terriers skittering around the floor, and she couldn't catch them, and she kept trying to catch them. She choked down the food that her friend brought her, only to throw it up again. The single unshielded light bulb that hung from the ceiling was too much for her, and she turned off the light, and she lay in the darkness of the room and the darkness of despair of alcoholism. A whole week of these heavy nerves and ghastly visions and terrifying sweats were accompanied by the love and the caring of an AA woman who sat with her, encouraged her, telling that being sober was a wonderful life. Katie knew that the life that she was living was not wonderful or worthwhile at all, and anything would be an improvement. She knew AA had worked for this kind lady, and perhaps it would work for her too. Today, at 80 years old, she knows that 12-stepping carried the vision of hope to her, and that she had been given the grace of continuous sobriety to sponsor other women into this wonderful new way of life. On January 1st, Miss Marie, my other sponsor, pregnant with her 7th daughter, walked out of the lives of her only living son, who was 14 years old, and the eldest of 7 other children. Many days and nights before that midwinter day, these young children couldn't account for her. Eventually, they came to know that their mother could be found in the neighborhood bar. The memories of her 3-year-old son being hit by a drunk driver while playing in the afternoon, his death, and the reenactment of those moments could not be stilled with alcohol. No amount of drinking could bring peace to her household or peace to her alcoholic husband. But at last, the children knew where she was, in prison, at the Ohio Reformatory. 12-stepping for Miss Marie was the gentle hand and heart of a sober woman who offered a way out of the alcoholic trap. Miss Rua B. Jones interviewed her, inquiring would she be interested in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Miss Marie replied, quote, "Yes, if you think it will help me understand my husband." It was after that that she attended her first AA meeting. And there were 2 meetings a week at that prison, carried by people like you and me. There was a speaker meet, open discussion meeting on Wednesday, and a speaker meeting on Sunday afternoon. And it was on one of those Sunday afternoon speaker meetings that her focus shifted from her husband to herself. She heard the story of Ruth R., and she came to believe that she, too, was an alcoholic. After that, she studied the big book and walked her steps alone in her room, as she says, as best I could. And while incarcerated, she didn't have a sponsor, as we know sponsors today. Miss Marie was active in AA. She and other women shared their experience, strength, and hope at open discussion meetings. They had a small publication of articles written by inmates that was published quarterly and sent to other institutions. After serving 1 year in the state prison, this institution for women, Miss Marie wondered if she could stay sober outside of these walls, a feat she could not imagine. She maintained her sobriety since that first day of incarceration and has been able to carry the message to other women, both in and outside of the detention centers. At 81 years old, she carries a weekly meeting into the prison and regular meetings to the local halfway house for women. She's active in her home group. She shares her story. She sponsors women. And she continues in general service. I told Miss Marie I'd been invited to share on the topic 12-stepping the old-fashioned way and asked her what she did to help women in those days. She told me about sitting in 2-hour shifts with the new woman. There were no treatment centers as we know today. Some apartments or rooms were available for the wet drunk to dry out. And they might have been giving a treatment of paraldehyde, which I had to look up on the Internet. It's a barbiturate acting as a sedative on the central nervous system. Today, people believe adding one sedative on top of another could be quite disastrous. And apparently, we lost quite a number of alcoholics through this recovery treatment. Miss Marie said that if they had, and if, she said, was a very big word, any kind of insurance, and depending on their condition, they would try to get the drunk to the hospital. And as an aside, she noted that she and her husband had Blue Cross Blue Shield, and her husband, Hollis, went to every hospital in the state of Ohio, and it didn't work. if the trip to the hospital was very far or it was out of town, they would carry some alcohol with them so that they wouldn't have DTs. She said few doctors were very knowledgeable about alcoholism, and this was prior to the AA outreach programs such as CPC, cooperation with the professional community, and public information. She said the disease and the discussion of the disease was always hush-hush. She went on to say, in the old days, we always had several big books on hand, and we certainly had literature and some meeting schedules. We always traveled in twos, and I can remember doing that, she said, that they would sit, and if one person couldn't remember something, the other person perhaps would. We usually limited our, as she called, visits to the home to 1 hour. She said that they would take the newly sobered up person to an AA meeting as soon as they stopped upchucking. And that the people began working their steps immediately and were guided through the program as quickly as they could move, sharing telephone numbers, giving rides to meetings, drinking coffee, and sharing feelings. All of these were part of the effectiveness of 12-step work. As Miss Marie spoke, I began to reflect on my own experiences in trying to help others. I met Ruby. I'm not sure I can say all of this. I met Ruby in a parking lot outside of Walmart. It was night. Those big lights were shining in the parking lot, and her two daughters were abandoning her. They had all they could have. She was in her late 60s. She was now homeless and hopeless. Two of us picked her up. We left the family members there. We took her sack of clothes. And we began the 1.5-hour journey to a treatment facility. From that moment, she began her new way of life. And she died just this year with almost 15 years of sobriety. And then there was the trip I took into what we would call the projects in the rural area of South Carolina. It certainly is not like the projects of a big city, but where people live that perhaps could use our help. And the lady who was in there in the room had been in and out of the rooms asking for money and rides and food. And we walked in, and there were feces all over the sofa. There was empty beer and whiskey bottles, cigarette burns. We offered her our recovery, and she didn't want it, and we buried her a few weeks later. Then there was the sponsee who drove with the family, taking a highly intoxicated woman to a treatment facility in another state. The time of returning home allowed her to describe to the family the disease of alcoholism as it is described in our big book, and to be available to the family members who were confused and angry. In South Carolina, in the upper part of the state, we don't get many phone calls to go to someone's house nowadays. But when we do, a couple of us women, we will bone up on the chapter working with others. And with God's help, we'll offer a solution. And sometimes the person grasps the new way of life, and others are not quite so blessed. Meanwhile, at my home group, the Pass It On group in Walhalla, South Carolina, we try to keep the meeting room open and someone there to greet the newcomer who is baffled by the blows of alcoholism. And if you know me well, you know that I am there with a sponsorship pamphlet for every newcomer. It's something I believe in, and through the action of sponsorship and service, I can demonstrate my gratitude for my new life given to me through love by Katie and Miss Marie. On September the 21st, Katie will celebrate 56 years of continuous sobriety, and Miss Marie will celebrate 43 on New Year's Day. Both of these ladies have been my sponsor only because there were other ladies who were willing to carry the message of AA and gave them hope. Even though I wasn't 12-step the old-fashioned way, I've gathered the blessings of my sponsors, Katie and Miss Marie. They taught me that my willingness to help another woman, and my apologies to Dr. Bob, is a sense of duty. It is a pleasure, because in doing so, I'm paying my debt to the woman and the women who took time to pass it on to me, and because every time I do, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Again, I would like to thank the General Service Board of U.S. and Canada and Doug Richardson for this opportunity to share with you my sponsors, Katie and Miss Marie, and allowing them a moment to touch your lives like they have touched mine. Thank you.
I think that was awesome. When I first came into the program, I had a sponsor that demanded that I call him every day. And so I said, okay, I'll call you at 6 a.m. every morning. That lasted for about 3 months. And he said, Bill, if you're going to call me, you've got to call me later than 6. And I said, well, I'm awfully busy. I'm working and I'm going to meetings and going to school. So I obtained another sponsor. And some of you may have heard him. He was on the speaker circuit for some time. His name was Chuck H. And as part of the sponsorship, he got me involved in conventions, and he got me involved in H&I committee, even though I couldn't have a panel because I didn't have a year's sobriety. And he would call me up on the telephone, and he'd say, Bill, I'm speaking tonight in Fontana, and you're driving. And that wasn't so bad, you know, because Fontana isn't all that far from Fullerton or Anaheim in Southern California. But when he called me up and he says, I'm speaking tomorrow night in Santa Barbara, he said, and you're driving, but I'll buy dinner. I said, for two of us? He says, well, all right. And so we drove up to Santa Barbara. Stopped on the way at a fish house in Malibu and had a dinner and went up and had fun. But his idea of sponsorship was to get me involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He impressed upon me, he beat it into me that involvement was the way to stay sober. You take the commitment and you keep the commitment. And I was not, like Eleanor, I was not 12-stepped into the program. But I have done some 12-step work of my own, both working with the wet drunks and also being of service. So that's just a little bit about me, and now I'd like to introduce Martin from Ontario.
Good afternoon. I too am an alcoholic. Welcome to Hamilton Group in Hamilton, Ontario. My name is Martin. You know, I was just listening to Elle there and I was thinking, maybe I should have prepared something. Now, I'm sure there's nobody in here, but it's like turning up to court without a lawyer. You know? Actually, I did get 12-step the old-fashioned way, you know. And, you know, I'm lucky because this conference, this international is in my, like, home area. And the woman who was very instrumental in me getting Alcoholics Anonymous is in the room, you know. And she was my mother-in-law's best friend. And they used to conspire against me quite regular. You know. Yeah. And when I came to Canada, you know, I came from Glasgow, Scotland originally, you know, and my God, what a place. If you were going to be an alcoholic, go and do it in Glasgow. Because it cuts a whole lot of time out, you know. Like, there's none of this trying to hang on to your decency or your respect. You just get right in. Well, But, you know, I want to tell you about two little guys called Jimmy. My first sponsor was a guy called Jim McGill, who had boxed for Ireland in the Golden Gloves in the lightweight, the middleweight division, and won it 4 years in a row. He was a tough little guy, you know, like in a. He didn't like me very much, you know. And well, we had something in common, right? But you know, I remember the morning I called Jim, and you know, and it was after a long, long time of hurting the people that I loved the most, and disappointing the people I hurt the most, and eventually robbing the people I loved the most of everything they had, you know, and. What had happened is my grandfather had died in Scotland. My mum and dad had sent me all the money they had to go home with the funeral, and I drank it. You know, and I didn't mean to drink it. You know, and I'm not hiding behind the drink. You know, but what happened? I went to get that money, £1,000. You know how much £1,000 is? Actually, it's $2,340.20 Canadian, but we left the cents in the jar. Right, but I went to get that money that morning and went for one bottle of beer to think about it. June the 25th, 1983. One bottle of beer. I wake up on July the 15th. Too late to go to the funeral. I'm in big trouble. Have you ever woke up when you know you're in really big trouble? Yeah. Gosh. So I wake up and there's all this trouble coming and I'm thinking, well, what am I going to do? You know, and I went home in my house and my wife had moved and went over to my mother-in-law's, you know, and it was I had married in 1979, the time of the Iran thing, you know, and they took the American hostages, and that's when I got married. And I used to call my mother-in-law the Ayatollah, you know. But I have to be really honest with you, she made the Ayatollah look like a humanitarian at the end of it. But anyway, I go into that house and my mother-in-law looks at me and she says, you know, Martin, you have to call your mother. And you know, guys, I knew I'd hurt my mother to no end. You see, I love my mother the way my mother had loved her father who had died. You know, and I had never meant to do what I'd done, but it was done. You know, and by this time I'm married to this little Canadian girl and I've got a wee girl and she's 2.5, almost 3, and Cheryl's pregnant again, and you know, and my life's just over. 25. You know, I suffered the alcoholic dilemma from I was 20. You know, there's two parts in our book where it talks about the word dilemma, and one of them is like a power reserve dilemma. That wasn't the part I'm talking about. I'm talking about the part where it says you made a decision. There's a dilemma created before we make a decision. And what happened for me was I used to get up every morning and pour a drink and have a decision to make. And I'd look at it and I'd think, you know, if I don't drink this, I'm going to die. And I'd think, if I do drink it, I'm going to die. And I drank that drink every morning until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, that morning I called. Oh, my mother-in-law gave me the phone. It was my mother, and my mother said this to me, and it was the worst thing that had ever happened in my life to that point. She says, Martin, I don't know where we went wrong. I don't know what we done wrong. But don't you come here, don't write here, don't phone here till you've done something with your life. Click. And I went and got drunk again. And I woke up on August the 1st, 1983, which was right out, and I had a quarter left. I had came to conquer Canada, and then I was going to get into the States after I had done the Canada thing, you know? You know, and I've got a quarter left, and I'm looking at it and thinking, you know, you know, like you can see the irony of it. You know, if it had been somebody else, I'd have been rolling about laughing, but it was me. And I put the quarter in the phone, and I phoned this little guy, Jimmy. And Jimmy was a guy who owned a lot of antique cars. There's another guy in the room who was sponsored by Jimmy. I think we're the only two guys ever sponsored because he was like a horrible wee man, you know. But he says to me, where are you? Such and such. She says, well, go in and tell them to get a cup of coffee and I'll cut. I says, I don't have any money for coffee. He says, well, go in and tell them to give you a cup and I'll pay for it when I get there. And my pride made me stand out there on August the 1st with a great coat on and a pair of jeans and a pair of big shirt and all that on because I just wouldn't get an ask for coffee. And he came down a 1962 Park Lane. And, you know, and I thought, well, this is the way I want to really travel. Like with red leather interior seats. And Jimmy came down in that car. And, you know, alcoholic, for me, do something to the new guy that never really happens a lot when you're drinking. A little guy showed me a courtesy that day, and I never realised it until a long time after. Jimmy got out of that big long car, and he walked all the way around it, and he opened the door, and he said, get in. And that's the first courtesy that had been given to me in 2 years. Because I was then living in the Stuart Street rail yards, and it was dog-eat-dog down there, you know. And some people were poodles, and some people were pit bulls. You know, and I had a stud collar on, right? So, but that was all about to change, because generally, you know, I'm quite a big guy, and I had boxed quite a bit in my younger days, and, you know, I could knock you out in one hit, and if I didn't knock you out, I could run away, you couldn't catch me. But this little guy, Jimmy, negated all that criteria. So, and he says to me, you're going to the detox. I would have went to the nut ward and did quite regular before I would go to the detox. Do you know what's in the detox, Jimmy? Alcoholics. He said, yeah, and you're gone. And he'd done something that hadn't happened from there for a long time either. He pulled out, Jimmy used to carry a wad of dough, right, because he was like a cash conscious guy, you know. He was always hiding from the government. And he pulled $10 off and he says, if you get a case of beer, you can still get a case of beer in America for $10, by the way, but in Canada, you can get a case of beer for $9.85. He said, you either go and get a case of beer, and that's it for me, or you do what I tell you. And I'm looking at the $10, and but I'm desperate. Have you ever been so desperate that your common sense actually works? I said, okay. And he put the $10 away. And he took me to the detox. And he started to do something to me that I try to do today. He started to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I hear a lot of messages, and I don't hear a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous in the message. I'm not really interested. I'm not really interested if your transmission blew up. I don't care. You know, like a guy says to me, my wife left with my sponsor. I says, go and buy my box of chocolates. Like, I'm not interested, I'm interested. And that's what Jimmy was interested in. And he said to me, Martin, you're going to go to meetings. Because I'm going to tell you, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that time, I had been here before and been here before and been here before, and it never worked until I was ready to listen. It never worked for me. And then you know what? It changed in me. I became desperate. And Jimmy said, you're going to a meeting. And he didn't say, you're going. He came and took me. And there's a son of a gun in this room who Jimmy couldn't make it one day because he'd work a double shift. And I thought, well, I'll just watch the TV the night, you know. It was Mocking Monday night, I thought, yeah, right. I'm in a halfway house with all these other winners, right. You know, in this room, there's, I don't know, but you could probably add up the time and there's thousands of years in there. I was in a halfway house with 31 guys and there was thousands of years in there, but they were all served in penitentiaries, right, you know. And I'm the only guy going to meetings, and all of a sudden the door goes. And there was this big guy in there. I mean, I've never really met a guy I was scared of, but I was cautious of this guy, you know. He says to me, will you get the door? I think it's the cops for me. I says, oh, okay. So I go to the door, and there's this guy, Joe, who's here. And I says, hey, what do you want? He says, Jimmy, can't make it tonight. You have to come to the meeting. I says, no, Joe, you don't. He says, yeah. He said, if you started any of that crap, like, get in the car. And so I started to get, and he says to me, you're going to join a group? Oh, I says, yeah, oh, I think I'll join that Triangle Action group. You know, there was like sandwiches there, and I seen shrimp there one time, and joining, he says, you're joining the Wayside Discussion. The Wayside Discussion was a group in Hamilton, used to call it the Friday Night Fights. You know, there was a few guys there with bad tempers, and I joined it, and there was an old Scots guy in there called Jock, who I just loved. And one thing leads to another, I end up the treasurer. You know, I ended up the treasurer. I was the only guy in the, except for Jock and Jimmy, I was the only guy in the whole group with a job. And so I wrote home to my mother, because she's trying to make amends. Dear mother, I am now the treasurer of my group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother said to Auntie Cathy, do you know my mom's high up in AA? I think he's going to be the president. So did I. But you know, Jimmy was a two-stepper. And Jimmy was sober enough to know that he couldn't help me. Because something happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, the woman's in here today. Georgina Bergeron gave me a hug one day. And I was a man that couldn't take a hug. You couldn't speak to me. You couldn't talk to me. I wandered about Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 months and spoke to 3 people. Just didn't know how. And I was scared to say it because I'd say the wrong thing. And my language was absolutely vile. And this woman came up and she gave me a hug. And do you know what it was? It was like my ma. And I've called Georgina ma ever since. It was just... And I decided to make amends to my mother and father. But when I went to tell Jimmy that, Jimmy says, Mom, I can't do that for you, son. He said, I want to know. And I ended up through a series of misadventures with another guy called Jimmy. And Jimmy Edmonds was the most incredible person I ever met. Besides my father, Jimmy Edmonds was the finest human being I met in my life. And he taught me how to make amends, you know. I said, Jimmy, I've said I'm sorry. He said, well, that's a good start. No? I said, what do you mean? He said, this is what you're going to do. And I flew home to Scotland, you know. And I'm going to tell you how I came off that plane in Scotland, and this is terrible. I came off in a wheelchair one time, you know. Came off in handcuffs. Like, if I was coming to, going to Scotland the way I was then now, a sky marshal would shoot me. I'm not kidding you. I used to have karaoke's on the planes, and it was terrible, you know. And I remember one time coming over here, and I was on a plane having a karaoke, and there was this English guy there. I hope there's no English in here, but they're great people, really great people. And this English guy's going, oh, I hate you, Scotch, I hate them. And I'm thinking, you're going to hate me a whole lot more because they cut me off in the bar about an hour ago and we're drinking his duty free. Oh, you want a drink? But I came off the plane in them conditions all the time. And my father used to have to come down to the airport with a bus fare to get me up the road because I never went home with any money. And this time I came off, I'm a little while sober and I got a suit on that I own and a coat, shirt and a tie. And my father looks at me and, you know something, I'm going to tell you, you've used new guys in Alcoholics Anonymous, when you see that look in somebody's face who loves you, you know this program's working. I mean, the people in AA will say to you, oh, you're doing great. But see, when my dad said to me, I hardly recognised you. And he put the money for the bus fare in his pocket and said, come on, we'll go get a taxi. And I got up to that house, and I'm going to tell you something. I got my mum and dad. My mum and dad died, and the only thing I took out of the house was this mirror. And this mirror is the most important possession I have. It's a brass mirror. It says on the back of it, 1776, the year your mob, one of the mobs down here got independent from us. Yeah. We'll get yous in the 12 and 12, I'm telling you. But that mirror was in the hall, and I'm going to tell you how I done the amend, because you see, the amends is so much part of the 12th step, isn't it? Because you can't tell a guy to do something you've not done. You know, and that's what happens a lot in AA now. Here's my advice, I'm not using it. You know? No. And I got my mum and dad by the hand and I said, Ma, Da, I'm sorry. That was the apology. And I look at my mother. My mother was off the Black Irish and she was crying. I knew she'd cry because I was her baby, yeah? And I look at that little hard man that had been decorated by the King of England during the Second World War, and he was the toughest guy I ever knew, that little guy, my dad. And I look at him and he's crying. And I look at this mirror and I'm crying. And then I say to him, I'm going to try and be a better son. The 12 step, the old fashioned way, came 100% in my life. So then I start to sponsor guys. And I say to them, you're going to go to a meeting every day. What have you said, Martin? You're going to have to take them. You know? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? So you've got to go out and look for other guys to make them take them, right? You know? And I had a guy come live with me one time, you know. Gary, he turned up at the door and he had a wee bag and he says, I've got nowhere to go. Could I stay for 3 days? I says, ah, come on in, Gary. He was there for 5 years. You know, I've got two wee girls. My second girl, Elizabeth, has never seen me drink. She's 21 now. You know, she's going to be a nurse. And my Veronica is like just looking at me, right, don't you? And Gary's sitting at the breakfast table one morning and they're tormenting him. And my wee wife says, hey, you guys. He's not here for your pleasure. He's here for your dad's. And I would... And you know something? I'm going to tell you the best advice I've got for MD who wants to do or get into 12-step work. Do the steps. Do the program of Alcoholics Anonymous how it's suggested. Don't go trying to save somebody's life when you're falling off a cliff yourself. You know? I've done them steps. And done them. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says to me, but I walk through it an archway of freedom. And that's what's happened for me. I have a hard time reconciling the guy I used to be to the guy I am today. You know, it's like having two lives. And you know, when I say to these guys, I get these guys in my truck and we go to meetings and I say, now listen, blah, 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 and you should be trying this, you should be trying that. Yeah, well, I don't really want to do that. I stop the truck and say, out. What? My truck, my gas, my advice, out. That guy, Jimmy Edmonds, that sponsored me. Jimmy's 40 years sober last September and died in June the 2nd this year. I was bringing Jimmy here to the old timers meeting with me, you know. And I'm going to tell you something. I never got to be with my mum and dad because they were in Scotland when they died and I was here. But I'm going to tell you something. Jimmy's family, I've been such a part of that family's life. Like, I was a nuisance, you know. You know, and... when Jimmy died, I was there. You know? And then I realised that's why the 12-step works. The 12-step works not because we give people advice, not because we make people do things they don't want to do, but because we get them to love themselves enough that they want to do it and give it away. I want to thank this committee for having me and these guys for being on the thing with me. Thanks so much.
Well, it's obvious I can't follow that act. Besides, I don't have a brogue. Very, very good friend of ours who had over 20 years of sobriety passed away not too long ago. And my friend Jim back in the corner and I were there on his last day. And Frank used to say, I've been given the opportunity to live two entirely different lives in one lifetime. And that's true in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as it was meant to be lived, you'll have a life beyond your wildest dreams. My sponsor beat it into my head that I should never go on a 12-step call alone. And I was on the 12-step list in central office, and if every time I got a 12-step call, I would call somebody that I knew in the program, and I'd say, I've got a 12-step call, will you go with me? One Sunday afternoon, I get a call from central office, and they say, you got a 12-step call, and you're supposed to meet this guy at this particular restaurant, and here's the phone number, and call him and tell him you'll be there. So I immediately get on the phone and I start calling people that I know in the program to go with me because I was following the dictum, you don't go on a 12-step call alone. And I called and I called and I called and some people weren't home, some people were busy. Finally I said, to heck with it, I'll go there. So I got in the car and I called him back and I told him what time I'd be there and I got in the car and I drove down to the restaurant. Sitting in the restaurant, he's sitting there drinking coffee. I think that's all right. That's a step in the right direction. And I sat in the booth opposite him, and it was one of these banquet-type booths, and introduced myself, and we started talking. And I could smell the alcohol on his breath, and it turned out to be one of the worst 12-step calls I ever made. Because he had no intention of getting sober. None whatsoever. However, it became apparent before very long that he wanted to establish a close personal relationship with me. I never went back. From that time on, I never went on a 12-step call alone. I learned my lesson. Now I'd like to introduce our next speaker. This is Roger, and he's an awesome guy, and he told me that I'll have to shut him off if he goes over time. Here's Roger.
Hi, folks. My name is Roger, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the High and Dry Group in Las Vegas, Nevada. We meet on Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. It's an open speaker meeting, and we invite you all there anytime you're in Vegas. We're around the corner of Las Vegas Boulevard in Bonanza. We meet at the U.S. Vets Cafeteria, so we hope you'll all show up there someday. My sobriety date is April 15, 1965. I was blessed with a... with some great sponsors, and one of them is here tonight, my friend Don, with 47 or 48 years over here. I picked up a drink when I was 13 years old, and I put it down 17 years later. And in the interim, I had a lot of trouble. I've often said if it was TA, Troubles Anonymous, I would have gotten here sooner. But I know today I was a teenage alcoholic, never knew it. And a judge one day said that I would go in the service or go to jail, and I became an instant patriot. So I was very fortunate to get out with an honorable discharge because the stripes were off and on, and they used to say, why don't you just put snaps on those? And because that's what happened. And a lot of trouble in there. But I won't go through all those details. I was brought up in Boston, Massachusetts, with five brothers and two sisters. My dad died when I was 9, and my mother could not control me. And my brothers, older brothers, were gone. And I just was self-will run riot from, 13, 14, 15 years on. And in the military, when I was sober, I could, be a decent soldier. I ended up with the paratroopers, and they taught us that we were real tough guys, and I believed all the bullshit they told us, But when I got out of the service, my older brothers, they had wives and children and homes and, normal lives. And I thought, well, it's time for me to settle down. And so I met this little Irish gal in Boston, and we got married. And everything was wonderful for about a year and a half. Before this, a trouble that I would get into seemed to bother everybody else but me, like my mother and brothers. And I remember my first sergeant was a great guy, and all these people, it really bothered them that I got into trouble, and it didn't bother me so much. But after I was married a year and a half, and we had what we call Irish twins, we had two little girls within 22 months, and now it's beginning to bother me. I don't want the trouble anymore. And so I tried to stop drinking, and one of the ways that I tried, I couldn't. I just couldn't stop. I mean, I couldn't stay stopped, as we found out in AA. I was a bender type drinker. I could stay off it for a while, and then I'd go crazy for days or longer. And so my wife suggested that I go down to the priest and talk to the local priest in the little town of Avon where we were living. And I went down and took the pledge. And this young curate, this young priest, right out of the seminary, I swear to God I had something to do with his nervous breakdown about a year later. But anyway, he got out the Bible, and I took the first pledge, I'd ever taken. I swear that I will not drink for 1 year. And 2 weeks later, I was back to him and said, listen, we must have done something wrong because I was bombed last night. And let's do it over again. And I really meant this, And so I did it again. And 3 weeks later, I'm drunk and drinking again. And I said, that's a lot of crap, the church and God and all that. And within 6 months, she had me in front of him again. And he suggested a psychiatrist. And I had done some things that I said, maybe I do have a screw loose. And so we went to the psychiatrist, and I don't think we sat with this guy for more than a half hour, and he had to sign a piece of paper, and he said, step in the other room, lay down. They strapped me down, and I got the first of 23 electric shock treatments. And I tell you something, it didn't do one thing for my drinking. I never forgot how to drink, but I did forget about a lot of other things, and even to this day, it's a wonder I can remember my own name. But that was the beginning of a real horror show for the next, within a year, I ended up in my first nut ward and strapped down and in the rubber room and all that business, and ended up in the VA hospital in Brockton, where some of my friends from Brockton, Mass. Are here. Are quite familiar with, and I tiptoed around those halls for about 6 months, thinking that I'm going to get this thing straightened out. And they would try different drugs on me, Octane, Miloril, Thorazine, if anybody's ever done the Thorazine shuffle. I did that for 6 months, and I thought they give me my little bag of jelly beans to go out and face the world. And between the pills now and the booze, if I wasn't nuts before, I really went nuts. And that was in 1960. I went to my first AA meeting, by the way, in this nut house, and I sat out there, and these people would come in and put on meetings, and I'm not one of them. You know, I'd rather have been the biggest nut in the nut house than one of those alcoholics. And that was my introduction to AA. And 5 years later, I came to AA, or rather 3 or 4 years later, I came to AA on my own through another priest who I tried to get back to the house because the wife was leaving with the kids. She had had it. She was ready for the nut house. And I tried to get him to go back to the house and put his little blessing on this family, and he didn't buy it. He suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll never forget this because I said to him, "Father, how can I be an alcoholic? I'm only 28 years old." And I meant that. You know, I thought you had to be at least 50 years old sucking on a wine bottle down in Skid Row. And he said, "Thank God, where else have you got to go?" Because I had tried everything I knew of, my wife knew of, my family knew of, not to stop drinking, but to straighten out my life. I may have been crazy, but I wasn't stupid, you know. I knew that things were not right. I mean, I owed everybody and his brother, and it was just a big mess, my life. So it was the last house on the block. It was AA or Amen. I said, "All right." He picks up the phone. He called the guy. And my friends here tonight from Brockton knew this man, Larry, who was my first sponsor. It was April Fool's Day, 1964. And he asked me if I could go the next day without a drink or a pill. I said I could. He brought me to an AA meeting in the YMCA. And I thought, wow, this is different, you know, but I had no, you know, I'm just getting here to get the pressure off. And somebody won a big book back there. We raffled off the big book around that area. And they said, "Is somebody new here that we could give the big book to?" And the guy that brought me says, "Yeah, I got a live one right here." And he gave me the book. I said, "Oh, I don't need it. Give it to somebody else." You know, And here it has Alcoholics Anonymous all over the book. I don't need this book. You know, everybody will know I'm in. Hey, well, anyway, he calmed my nerves down a little bit. He took the cover and he turned it inside out for me. Oh, thank God, you know. Now I'm walking out of this place thinking somebody might see me, and don't I run into a coach, about, you know, a little league a coach from my town, which is right next door. And he said, "What are you doing here?" "Oh, I just come down to meet some friends." And I ran away from him. I couldn't tell anybody. But this little town I lived in, they had two liquor stores and two taverns or cafes. And I was shut off in all four of them. But I was so afraid that somebody's going to know that I'm a drunk in the town, you know. And they knew that I had, you know, been missing for time. So where was he, you know, and he's off in some other nut house again. Or, I mean, he's in jail again. Or he's... But all of these tragedies that were going on during that time, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I really didn't. And I'd go to AA and I'd stay. And I'd meetings every night of the week. And 40 years ago, there weren't that many meetings as there are today. But I was at a meeting practically every night of the week. And I'd stay sober a week and stay sober a couple of weeks and I'd be drunk again. And we referred to them then as 25 percenters. And these guys that I joined, the Canton Friday Night Group, which my sponsor over here, Ducky, was started the group. And that saved my life, absolutely saved my life. Because I finally, after 4 months, went to this man, Larry, and I said, "Listen, every time you bring up the word honest, every time we have a conversation, you bring up the word honesty." And, of course, I hadn't been very honest in my life. But I said, "I'm going to be honest with you. You know, when you, with a bunch of ducks, it's easy to quack like a duck and act like a duck. And, you know, like I can say I'm an alcoholic. But do I honestly believe it? I really don't believe I'm an alcoholic." He says, "Well, what do you think you are?" I said, "I just think I'm crazy." I said, "I mean, I can't sleep. My nerves are shot. I'm jiggy. I'm shaky. I don't know whether I'm going left or right. I'm just nuts." And, he said, "Well, you know what I think you are?" I said, "No." He says, "I think you're a crazy alcoholic." And he says, "If you don't do anything about your alcoholism, you'll never do anything about your craziness." And I tell you, I hung on to that for 2.5 years. Because in the big book, it talks about those that are mentally or emotionally disturbed but have a capacity to be honest, have a shot at this way of life. And I hung on to that for 2.5 years. And in those 2.5 years, he explained the third step to me, which turned my life around in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. I kept waiting for me to screw this up. Because that's my nature. That's what I do. I'm an excellent screw-up. You know, you hand me a good thing, watch me screw this thing up. Just a matter of time, and I'll screw it up. And I could see the goodness in Alcoholics Anonymous. I belonged here. I found a home here. But I thought, somebody like myself, one of these days I'll screw this up. And the grace of God, I haven't. And I don't have to. Because they taught me things like I had to learn how to listen. To listen, to learn. I didn't know how to listen. You know? While you were talking, I was thinking about what I'm going to say to you. I could give a damn what you're thinking. You know? And little things like that. And how to keep it simple. I could screw up a one-car funeral. Never mind. You know, keep it simple. I really mean that. These little gems in my life today, and easy does it, I have no idea what easy does it meant. I had no idea what it meant. Because I couldn't sit through a movie when I got to Hong Kong. I couldn't sit through a subway, you know, in Boston. It was a subway. I'd have to get off every two or three stops. And they're talking about easy does it. You know, I remember one day, and Don remembers this guy. I can't remember his name. He was in our group, and he lived in Avon. He had about 12 years in the program, and I one day went by with a friend, and he was sitting in a hammock reading a book on a Saturday afternoon. Sun's out. He's reading the book. He's got a little lemonade alongside him. I saw this picture, and I couldn't, how can he do that? How can anybody just sit there? You know? Really, this was a big deal to me. And I just look at this guy. He's over 12 years, and he's just, you know, he could care whether there's, what's going on in the rest of the world. And that impressed me so much. I said, if there's anything I want out of this program, it's that easy does it thing. And you know, today I know what that means, that serenity, that peace of mind. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And because it gave me this, my children had a shot at a normal way of life. I have three beautiful daughters. One of them's an AA baby. She wouldn't be here if it wasn't for AA. I mean, it's miraculous. They all went to college. One of them got a master's degree. They were able to take their friends home to the house without worrying about Dad, whether he's going to come home drunk. They've had a decent life. And all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe everything that I have to Alcoholics Anonymous. After 12 years of sobriety, I got divorced. My wife was active in Al-Anon. But it just didn't work. Just did not work, no matter what we did. And today, my beautiful wife today of 18 years, we've been married and have had a wonderful life together. And a great relationship with my children and grandchildren. And you know, this is about 12-step in the old-fashioned way, and I get taken off by all these other things, but I had to think of on a couple of occasions of what we did when we did 12-step work. Somebody mentioned it earlier tonight about how we were on a 12-step call list and we'd get these calls and would always go with somebody else. And if there was a gal we were going on, we always took a woman with us. And some of the experiences that we had, the last one I went on back in Massachusetts was a friend of mine who was a godfather of my first child. And we were very close friends for years. And I got him around the program years ago, and he was in and out, and a very bright guy. He was a professor at a college, and just a great guy. And I went on my own when he called me, and he ended up taking a swing at me. I mean, we were like this, you know, and I had to leave his place. And I just found out a year ago that he came back to AA, and was sober 2.5 years, and I called him down in Florida. And I hadn't spoken to him in, 13 years or more. And but when I heard he was sober in AA, I called him, and he said, "Roger, just went out 2 weeks ago." So, you know, how come we're sitting here sober and guys like him, they don't get it? You know, I've often wondered that. Why us? When there are thousands out there dying. I mean, it absolutely is the grace of God. And for people like myself, that is a 25% of that's been in and out, it's a divine grace of God that we got here and stayed here. And I also believe that in this, keeping this, we must give it away. I learned this from my friend Ducky, John here, and others. And you know, just because somebody's been sober a long time, that doesn't mean they don't need a 12-step call. My good friend Wally over here from Brockton was sober a few years. And I met him one day, he'd just gotten married a few months earlier. And he moved out of town, and I said, where are you living? He told me where he's living. I said, what group are you in? Oh, well, I used to be in the group down in Brockton. I said, what group are you in now? Oh, you know, I haven't got one yet. And I said, where's your big book? Oh, I gave it to somebody who needed it. I go, really? I says, how about your sponsor? Who's your sponsor? Well, I had one. You know, I used to have one. I said, hey, come with me tonight. And he joined the group. And he's often mentioned this. You know, without his realizing it, he got away from AA. He got away from meetings. Another good friend of mine, Steve M., who's in Duxbury Group in Duxbury, Mass., 38 years or more ago, he heard me speak at a meeting, and afterwards he came up and talked to me. And I eventually became his sponsor. And he was like myself, in and out. And one day he was on a little runner, and I thought, well, just maybe. And it was a Monday morning. I knew where he drank on a Monday morning. In Stoughton, at the VFW hall in Stoughton. It's a dive down in the basement. 9 o'clock in the morning, he often talks about this at a meeting. He says when the phone rang in that joint, all the guys would say, if it's for me, bartender, I'm not here. And so he said, I would go right along with it. He says, of course, it was never for me, but he said, hey, if it's for me, bartender, I'm not here. But he said, there were only two or three guys in the bar that morning, and about 9 o'clock, and the phone rang, and he says, I didn't bother saying anything. He goes, nobody would call me. And the bartender says, hey, it's for you. And I was on the other end of the line, and I said, have you had enough? And he said, yes. And I went and picked him up, brought him to the VA hospital. They just opened up a detox there, and he hasn't had a drink since. So you never know. You just never know. I mean, I've often said, I don't get anybody sober, and I don't keep anybody sober. What I try to be is a power of example. Because those people ahead of me were a powerful example to me. I saw what they did and how they kept AA together in the Boston, Brockton, Massachusetts area. I saw what these men did, how they went out of their way constantly to be of some help or service to the active alcoholic. And I believe that's our job, to be responsible. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life that I could not possibly describe to you. I mean, from where I came from and the life that I've had the past 40 years. As they used to say, if you made a list of all the things that you would like when you came around this program, I would have fallen very, very short of that list. I mean, to have the love and respect of my wife and my children, my grandchildren, my friends. I have a host of friends all over the country. And even out of the country. I went over to Germany to visit my son one day. I have a son, by the way. He's bigger than I am. And he comes up and puts his arms around me and gives me a kiss in the cheek and tells me he loves me. I mean, you can't buy that. I can remember my friend Wally when he was... when his daughter... a few years back, was married to an active alcoholic. And his nephew, I happened to be sponsoring also, his nephew called me up one day and he said, Roger, Wally's out of his mind. He's going after his son-in-law. He's going to kill him because he had beaten up his daughter. He says, you've got to go help him. I said, where is he? What are you going to do? I says, I'm going to help him find that son of a bee and hold him down while he kills him. I mean... the point I'm getting at is we don't grow any wings around here, you know? I have three daughters. I can't imagine somebody hurting my daughters. another experience I had with a guy that I sponsored in Brockton who was separated and divorced, and he had three children, and one of his children wouldn't go with him when it was his time to go with him. I says, you're the father, he's the son. You know, you want that child with you, you go take him. He says, well, how am I going to do it? I said, I'll help you. And I did. We went over and took that kid and took him out of the house and put him in the car and brought him to his. And today, he and his dad are like this. I mean, I don't know. There are so many things that I just feel that we have an opportunity to help in so many other ways. Not only not drinking. I mean, that goes without saying. We have to not drink or take substitutes first. But there are so many other ways that I think that we can be of service and of help to the alcoholic that's trying to work this program. I'm honored to be here. I can't believe that they had asked me, the powers to be in this convention, to ask me to speak at this meeting. I'm just so honored to have been asked. Anyone that's been around this program a while and realizes the worth of this program, it's indescribable. It's referred to as the miracle of the 20th century. And I believe that. And like I said to my friend, he hasn't thrown the hook out to me yet, so I won't shut up yet. But one of the past Secretary of State in the country of USA said he was asked at a news conference what he thought the most important thing that happened in the 20th century. Without hesitation, he said Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's not a member of AA. The lives that we affect, and everything, obviously, when we see tonight the flag demonstration, I mean, the flag parade, it's just fantastic how we've reached all around the world. This thing is just keeps growing and keeps growing and keeps getting better. You know, and the young people that are coming into AA, it's so fabulous to see the teenagers coming into AA. And they're latching on. And people aren't saying to them anymore, hey, you know, I drank more than you spilled. You don't hear that anymore. And that's great. Because it's the way that we live that we have to be taught. And those kids, they're just reaching out. Their ears are wide open to learn how to live. Because that's how my eyes, ears and eyes were when I got here. I wanted to learn how these people lived so beautifully. How they were so happy all the time. The serenity thing. I never heard the word serenity in any bar I ever drank in. You know? I never did. You know, I never had some guy come up that wasn't gay and come up and say, I love you, pal. Never had that. Give you a little hug? Whoa, that would be scary, you know? But you get all of those things and more here. I've made so many friends in Las Vegas since I've been here. My good friend Fran. She and I have known each other since 1980, I guess, or somewhere around there. I guess I'm running out of words and babbling, but I want to thank all of you people for being here, and I want to thank the convention people for asking me to speak. And God bless you all.
Thank you all for being here. You know, I haven't been sober all that long, but I've been sober long enough to watch the miracle happen. And the miracles are all sitting in this room, and you exhibit that on a daily basis. And as my friend just said, we're not angels. It's progress, not perfection. It's learning how to grow and how to grow up. When I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a machinist. Prior to that, I had been in the Marine Corps for a while. And so I knew all those words. And I utilized and used all those words because it was hip, slick, and cool. So I was at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach one night. And I was doing my usual, which is spouting off and showing my vocabulary. And this lady, after the meeting, this lady got a hold of me. She took me by the ear. Now, I'm 48 years old, 49 years old, and she takes me by the ear and she says, young man, and I don't think she was that much older than I was. She said, you come into the program and you sober up, and then you grow up, and then you clean up, and that includes your rotten, filthy mouth. And so I have tried to follow that advice for a while, and it seems to have worked. I have three children who have graduated from college. They're all married and raising families of their own. And like Roger, they tell me they love me and give me a hug. And I never thought that would happen. And I have been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous just almost as long as I was married drinking. And if my wife and I make it through October, we will celebrate 50 years of sobriety. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. 50 years of marriage. It only seems like 50 years of sobriety. But it's 25 years of sobriety and 25 years of alcoholic drinking. And the difference is that we have a relationship today. And it comes from being able to give what I have so freely been given. And you can't keep it unless you give it away. And 12-stepping is the best way to exhibit this by passing on, not preaching, but passing on to others who have this problem of alcoholism, what you have been so freely given. And I want to thank you all for being here, and I want to thank the committee for asking me to chair this meeting. And once again, my name is Bill Estep, and I am an alcoholic from Southern California.